total n-dimensional fluctuation of the metric, here it is. These are the decomposition of the modes, and this is a function of this x, and then the m is a label, which really is m1, m2, all of the different indices. Okay, but I'm just describing this m. But you get the point. So there is then a huge number of these modes, all equal by this. Each one of these modes corresponding to a physical particle in four dimensions. If this were, as I said, if this were just one sum, well, then this would just be e to the I m1, call it m1, m1y over r. And then you can see this literally is exactly just a Fourier expansion. So the fact that this is a product over a whole series of modes is just one of the different possible fluctuations you can have in the different dimensions, in the different directions you can go in the extra dimensional space. This blob here, HMN, has a bunch of components to it. So it has components that you can write as the mu pieces, the just ordinary space-time pieces. There is a series of pieces that we can write h mu, say, 5, h mu, 6. Maybe my h's are terrible, but that's good, because I can give you. And then a series of scalar fields, where now here I and j, you know, run from 5, 6, whatever, up to 4 plus n. Yeah, 4 plus n. So the interpretation is we have a 2-index object. This is a spin 2 object. It's a graviton. We have a 1-index object. This is a gauge field, okay, and corresponds to some gauge invariance of the gauge direction. And we have something with just single indices here, and these are a series of scalars. So this n-dimensional graviton splits into a series of modes which are just 4D gravitons plus some vectors plus some scalars. Obviously, the original hunk of these guys, hence the names, and hence why you hopefully are going, oh yeah, I remember that now, right, is that the hope of these guys was that you could take electromagnetism and embed it. And to see why that's not going to work here, I'll let you go through it. It's pretty easy to see. You'll see it very, very quickly. All right. So this is the expansion of the fluctuations, small fluctuations about the background, flat space time. Now what we need to know is, well, how do these fields couple to the standard model? Because that's how we're going to try to find them and observe them at the LHC. Now we said that, you know, the extra dimension picture was there was a surface in the extra dimensions where the standard model fields were assumed to live, and we said we're just going to put a delta function there to determine. So what do I mean by that? I mean that the energy momentum tensor is going to be the energy momentum tensor of the usual 4D standard model. And times n dimensional delta. Check the dimensions for this. So that's good. To just get the indices together, you can do something like this. Where obviously what that means is that when these indices are not mu or nu, not 0 to 3, then it's 0. So what that means is that TMN has non-zero components only when u and nu are non-trivial. Here, I'm again, imagining the coupling to the standard model, that's the important thing. It becomes more complicated if you want to put the Proudhon scattering itself. We're not going to worry about it. That's not important. So now, how do we do it? How do we proceed? Okay, well, we've got our expansion of the Proudhon. We have our energy momentum tensor, and how we couple this to the standard model. We just plug it into Einstein's equations and figure out the coupling. This is a tedious procedure, of which I'll sketch a couple of steps, but it is straightforward. So the Einstein's equations for this are the GMN, the combination of the Ricci scalar and Riemann tensors, attractive Riemann tensors. People do some choice of sign. I can put it plus, but I know if I have minus. There we go. So this is just the n-dimensional, the 4 plus n-dimensional Einstein equations. If we plug in TMN of this form, you can see very quickly that the only non-zero components are going to be those which are G mu nu. And all of the other components, so G mu 5, G I j, or if I be a little more fancy, I'll write this as G mu I, mu running over space-time, I running over the extra dimensions. Okay, so what does this mean? It means that the standard model on a brain sources gravity, but gravity only as it propagates in union components. What does that mean? It means that in practice, the only modes that are coupling to the standard model are the gravitons, H mu nu. It's this step that is tedious that I'm skipping. In other words, you can take the expansion of this series of modes, do this, plug it into the full Einstein equation with this energy momentum tensor, turn the crank, and you will find that you can compute the coupling of the gravitons to stuff, to standard model matter, and you're going to find that these guys couple. And in fact, if I go ahead and put this in and I work out what HMN is equal to, it's then going to be equal to something that has as one of its terms E mu nu over M conf squared. It's not quite this, it's actually this plus a term that where you do tracing and you have these, but maybe I'll just write it. The point being that it does indeed couple the T mu nu, and it has a strength that goes like M Planck squared. This is the 4D plus. Like we said last time, I was going to have this well-defined notation where M Planck is a fixed 2×10^18 GeV number, the usual 4D Planck scale, and this is the one that we're imagining could be as small as TeV. Even as much as this is the true fundamental Planck scale of this theory of strength and gravity. This relation then tells us how these guys couple as opposed to the H mu I and H I j. So all of these modes. Yes?
There's a box.
Here's a box. Oh, yes, there's absolutely. Oh, well. Yeah, I didn't write this out, but yeah, so what you'll end up with is an equation of motion. Which will, you're absolutely right, as derivatives, you know, and in fact, let me be more precise. So you will have something that will look like box plus a momentum square here. Well, let me just call it K square, where the K square corresponds to whatever the momentum would be. K squared corresponding to the momentum of the extra dimension, which when you close the line expand will turn into the mass squared in particular. So can I, so exactly. So this is the formula. You're absolutely The point of my project, again, is that I can, rather than spending all day going through indices, you can see quickly that this is the physics foundation. There is one exception to this rule. There is actually a single scalar mode that you have, single scalar that depending on the number of dimensions, so only if the number of dimensions is more than one, there's actually a single scalar at each kk level that actually couples to the trace of the energy moment condenser, E mu mu. There is a scalar that does this. This is something that corresponds to, if you like, the gradient or the dilaton, the scalar that corresponds to fluctuations of just the size of the information, rather than just tension modes. This is all we will have to concern.
Can you please also knows on the Dalton scale? Can you do it?
Yeah, there's actually a couple of pieces to it. So there is a scalar, you're absolutely right, there is a scalar corresponding to the broken translation invariance, and where did it show up? Well, a series of those showed up as one of the number of extra polarizations that go into these states. Because remember, so a graviton that has a mass, here's the mass corresponding to the different configurations of momenta in the extra dimension. A graviton with a mass has more than two polarizations. It has five. It's straightforward to see the counting. Those five correspond to what? Well, just like a vector field adds one scalar to become massive, having three polarizations, this adds a vector as well as a scalar to become massive. Right, hence the five polarizations, two of the vector, one of the scalar. And that one extra scalar, one of those gets absorbed in each of these modes. And there is remaining, there are, in, when you have more than one dimension, you have remaining degrees of freedom.
So these body photons are not actually the gauge built in standard models, since the particular choice of energy momentum systems doesn't give you the correct equations. But can you modify this in some way to make them?
There's a good research problem. Go try to do it. Kaluza Klein tried for a while in the 20s.
Is that physical random, or was it couldn't do it?
You know, it's a very interesting question, but I'm going to leave it to Afwan. Otherwise, it'll take me too far. It's an interesting question. Now and then, I have come back to this and stared at it, and every time I keep an eye and go. So that should just simply say that, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. You guys do. So you should think about it yourselves and see if there's some way. But it's clear that even if I start to fiddle with this, I'm still stuck with this couple looking like 1/(n)2. That I just put that in as a comment, it's a seeming stereo. Okay. Once we have the expansion and we have how they couple, we then need to get an idea of how many are there. Well, there are an infinite number of them, of course, but an infinite number up to the cutoff scale. But we can quantify that more precisely by counting how many states are there between 1/(r), where the first mode would show up. Or the first series of modes would show up, okay, if I take, say, m1 equal to 1 and all these others equal to 0, or for the other modes, then I'm going to have some number of states here, and then more and more modes if I keep on going up. Eventually, I will get to near m star, and it's at that point then the effective theory breaks down, because at that point, that's where long gravity is. So we can try to count the modes between one over r to n star. And that counting turns out to be fairly simple. I'll show you how this works. So had this been just one dimension, we would have had this index m1 going from some range. But let's take the range in the following way. So m would correspond to, there is a 0. So I'm taking n equal to 1. There's only one index. If m equal to 0, what is this mode? Well, m equal to 0 here causes this thing to be 1. Okay, and m equal to 0 here, well, if this is 0, this whole thing is 1. And then I try to act to figure out what this mass is. You're going to find that, you act with derivatives, you're going to get act with extra dimensional derivatives, you're going to end up with a 0 here. What is that? That's a massless graviton. That is nothing other than exactly the graviton that we have in 4D. So this is the usual 4D massless system. There are then the other modes, so plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, and all here. How high can I go? Well, I'm starting at 1 over r, and I can go up to n star. So the largest number is going to correspond to m star divided by 1 over r, if I can write it that way. All right, this is this scale divided by that scale, and that's going to count all of the modes. All right, so this is just m star times r. And there's a, maybe a 2, okay. We're not for one. And flatter. Yes, I could, but you can convince yourself that it'd be for n star large enough, I don't have to worry about that. All right. If I had done n equal to 2, well, then I would have had two series of modes, n1 and n2. Okay? And again, there's going to be one mode where m1, m2, and all the other indices are 0, corresponds to the usual graviton, and then a whole series of modes. And it's fairly easy to convince yourself this would go like n star r squared. So then if I do this for just n dimensions, we'll go over into n. There I am. Okay, so those are all the modes. We can write this in an even nicer way. So we can just say the number of modes between 1 over r up to m star equal to m star r to the n, but from the famous formula that I conveniently erased, this quantity corresponds to just m block divided by m star quantity squared. Remember, up to a 2 block. Up to a 2 block. This is what this is. Meaning m star, because what we had previously was m star to the n plus 2 times 2 pi r to the n, that equal to the Planck scale. Now we can just convert this over, and we see no matter how many extra dimensions we have, this is the counting of the modes. Okay, now, let me now tell you why this is. Before I do that,
so always modes correspond to like the massive spherical particles they have to make sure we can run through the list of vector quantum?
All these correspond to Say the question again.
So they correspond to some spin field particles.
Yep.
And you have to see how they affect the energy.
Precisely. Or more just more simply, how do we interact with those? Yeah, we don't even know yet if they're dangerous or not, or we don't know anything. We're just trying to figure out what's the consequences of modifying gravity holding the standard model constant. Okay, so you could look at this and you could say, well, wait a second, this is somehow strange. How is it that the number of modes here work out to be the same regardless of n? Right? Surely if we start changing the number of dimensions, the number of modes. But remember, what's the physics of this? The physics of it is we have a gravity propagating in extra dimensions. It was able to spread out in the extra dimensions. It had a small overlap with us. That corresponds to in n dimensions as a series of Kaluza-Klein modes, a series of these modes, of which as I hit more and more of these modes, eventually the theory is getting stronger and stronger cut, and eventually I get to go. But whatever that should be, it should be a fixed number of modes. It shouldn't matter how many dimensions, okay? Because each of these modes is coupled in exactly the same way, 1/n log. So the fact that it was the same number is not surprising at all. It is exactly what you expect. Okay, so this is the density of states. How dense are we talking about? Well, remember, what is the size, or what is the scale corresponding to 1/r? We had before that R for, say, n equal to 2, despite this being potentially ruled out, this was R with 1 millimeter. If I just convert that into a scale 1/r, the numerical value I get is, and this is not surprising to you, I won't be constant, 0.03 eV. So what does that mean? It means that if you have two dimensions and you were looking at this separation, you would start with the first graviton being a mass that is almost like a neutrino mass level, okay? And then it would go from there, and then up it goes. Very quickly, this density of states gets really, really dense. Okay? You can convince yourself of that. I mean, it's going like a powerball in terms of the density of states. Just to give you a few other numbers, so this is for n equal to 2, for n equal to 4, n equal to 6, okay. This is 0.1 MeV, and what did I have? In all of these cases, this is a really tightly spaced spectrum, something where the spacing is so tight that you are unlikely going to be able to distinguish, you know, one from another. I mean, imagine you go up to an energy of 100 GeV, and you start scattering, you produce some of these things. How would you know you've got one and not the other? Well, you'd have to have a resolution at this level. And clearly, unless this is much larger than this, you're not going to be able to resolve the difference between one graviton to another. And this is significant for LHC. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it generally nothing complex?
Yes.
Yes. This number of modes change?
Yes. Yes.
So it's not a topological invariant, it's just...
It is not a topological invariant. You will qualitatively change the situation if you change the geometry.
Can you add something here to make a topological invariant? I mean, it's something like curvature or...
Possibly, yes. But the difference is that what we're doing here is we have a series of modes that whose wave functions themselves are flat in the extra dimension. Whereas if you change the curvature of the extra dimension, then you change also the profile of that wave function. And it's in changing that profile that then that's what causes many other things to change.
But the Fourier expansion of the root function would become
a
superposition of other functions.
Yeah, it's not
really based on functions.
Yeah, it would be based on functions or other geometric
orthogonal
functions. So it doesn't matter the number.
Counting and the separation of these are structural.
But the number is still a number, right?
The number is a number, but remember the strength of the coupling is different. So you have to rethink what you mean by the number of modes. It's best to leave this still. I don't want to spend too much time. Okay. Good. So individual gravitons then have a spacing determined by this 1 over r scale. And they have a coupling to matter that goes like 1 over m plus squared. Okay. Well, a coupling to the matter energy momentum density goes like 1 over m. If we now consider at our famous collider the production of a single graviton mode, this is a proportional sign, not an alpha. Okay, this cross section is what? This is, remember, what are we doing here? We're doing some sort of partons go together. How do I want to write this? Say, I can do this. Oh, dotted lines to sort of distinguish one from another. I'm thinking a specific process for a specific reason. If you hold your thought as to why I'm doing this for a moment. So here are a couple of quarks popped out over a proton using the usual thing, PEFs. We go into some intermediate Higgs boson, could be a photon. This couples to the graviton, through the energy momentum tensor, and so you spit out one of these guys. What's the strength of this coupling? Here, the strength of this coupling is proportional to momenta. Let me just write it as P, without being busy for a moment, divided by m block in the amplitude. Because obviously, the energy momentum tensor, when you expand it, has got multiple components, and maybe it's tough. Okay, so then, if I take this coupling and square it, total cross section will be proportional to 1 over m plot squared. Okay, so we'll have that factor. This means what? It means it's incredibly tiny. Right, whatever momentum you can possibly think about, the LHC expressed by 1 over m plus square, it's dead. You're never going to see any production of a graviton, of a single graviton. Now, but remember, we have a huge number of modes to work with. M plus squared over n star modes. So if we sum over all of the modes, we can compute the inclusive cross-section of the cross-section to produce any graviton, not any one particular one, but just one of an ensemble of a whole bunch of them. And when I do that, I will have a 1 over m plot squared times the number of modes from over there, converts into something that is proportional to 1 over the fundamental quantum gravity scale over m star squared. This means that while the probability to produce any mode is incredibly suppressed, the probability to produce one mode only depends on a cross section whose characteristic scale in the problem is 1 over the TEV scale. This is completely doable. This is something where you can then try to find.
How would they look like?
Good. How would they look like? How do they couple? How does any individual graviton couple? Right? Which has a strength of 1 over which scale? 1 over the regular 4D log scale. So that, okay, so now we've got a state suppressed by 1 over n log scale. It's moving along. What is it going to do? Well, it's heavy, and there's nothing to prevent it from decaying. It does not carry any conserved quantum numbers for it from decay. So it'll decay. So it's going to decay. Well, what's the process by which it'll decay? It will decay through, say, something like this, into a couple of photons. That's certainly a possibility for any of the gravitons we're contemplating. What's the strength of the coupling? 1 over n quantum. What's going to be the decay rate if this is an incredibly suppressed couple? The decay rate would be really, really long. Really, really long. Great. I almost was going to do this anyway. This, at the end of the day, the session, this is a great exercise. Is to compute, or estimate, not compute. Estimate, because computations are not, it's much better to estimate. Estimate the decay, the lifetime or the width of a graviton going into two photons. It's a very interesting number. And has important cosmological implications. But clearly it's long on the time scale of a collider. So that means that the graviton will escape, will even produce this thing, and it will escape from the detector, just like a neutrino, just like dark matter. Its couplings are sufficiently weak, you're not going to see it interact. That's, by the way, why I consider the process of graviton plus photon, because if I had produced, say, a single graviton or two gravitons, that would just be missing energy in the detector, and how am I going to find that? That doesn't look like anything. So that's no good. So the way that this is done in a collider, which Kao's going to talk more about in many other interesting things, is to look for, say, the recoil of the photon against a massive graviton and or against an ensemble of massive gravitons, and in that way you can try to look for a system. Let me make one more comment about this. The fact that this came out as one of the stars. Where? This was something that was actually not surprising at all. I found an eraser. Okay. This is something that is. Not surprising at all. If I were to think purely in extra dimensional language. So rather than going to 4D language and Kaluza Klein expand and look at all these modes, which is the only way I can immediately understand how these things work, I can at least qualitatively understand how this works in extra dimensions, because here's the process that I'm contemplating. So there's a bunch of standard model fields, they're stuck to this surface in the extra dimension of the brain. They emit a graviton, but now this graviton is emitted into the extra dimension, quote unquote. What does that really mean? It means that it can go wherever it wants to go. Now, in practice, what we saw over here is the notion of quote unquote movement in the extra dimension corresponds to this tower of modes. But that's equivalent to saying that I just have this graviton moving in the extra dimension. What's the strength of this coupling? Well, if I did this in a 4 plus n dimensional calculation, the strength of this coupling is just 1 over n sohar to whatever power, n plus 2 over 2. And once you normalize this properly, you will find that you end up with a cross section that is the same thing. So the characteristic scale of emitting a graviton in an extra dimension, this was the only scale of the problem. It had to be this. And we saw that when you sum over modes, okay, there are all, as I said, I gave you an exercise about the decay of the graviton. That's a wonderful thing to do. You can already guess that there could be many potential consequences in astrophysics as well if we start having a large number of new particles new massive particles showing up at these different scales. An interesting thing is then to contemplate what are many of those astrophysical consequences. That was going to be one of my exercises, but maybe this decay is nice. Perhaps what I will do is I will add the following and say, well, you've got this, so then you can take, what you can do is you can take this and say, well, how many gravitons do I have? And that's the interesting question. Try to compute the number that you got. More specifically, to compute the dependence on the number of gravitons that you produce as a function of the highest temperature the universe ever got. What's the highest temperature? Well, we don't know. We know the following. We know it had to have gotten up to an MeV, which is something I talked about last time, so that we got the Big Bang nucleosynthesis up. But beyond that, we don't know. So you can compute, well, as I keep on raising the temperature, what happens is that I'm going to keep on producing more and more of these modes from just the thermal plasma. And from the arguments that we just talked about here in this decay, you can see that once you produce one of these modes, they very rarely interact. And so they are just going to be these, you know, massive particles produce, and then they'll do whatever they're going to do in the universe, but they're going to stick around for a long time. And it's the fact that they stick around for a long time, but don't live forever, which is one of the problems.
So,
constraints. Yeah.
So if they exist, can we try to get electron bent from them in LIGO, for example?
Good. You know the answer to this, actually. So you know the answer to this almost right away. And here's how to see it, right? LIGO is how big? Macroscopic, couple of kilometers. The scale, the maximum scale that we've seen in the deviation of gravity is this. The characteristic scale of these things is really small. So the scale are just completely off to see one versus another. You would also have had to have had a huge density of these modes, a huge number of modes to be able to see them. And the density in LIGO's case comes not from a strong coupling so much as having a large system, right? A star that collapses or a binary spiral. So it's an amplification by a large number of particles, which is quite the large LIGO system. Okay, there are many more things you can do at colliders and see what the consequences are, but you've already got enough of the feeling for this to see what it means to modify gravity, not the standard model, keeping the cutoff scale at the TPV. But I said that we always face this problem, that if the cutoff scale is 1 TPV, what happens, how am I supposed to interpret it? All of these higher dimensional operators in the theory that violate global symmetries or lead to weak effects or do whatever they want to do. As I said, this is a problem no matter what scheme you're thinking about. It's generically a problem in supersymmetry and in Beckenbauer and extra dimensions. Everything you think about, it's dangerous to violate the global, the accidental global symmetries of the standard model. In this context, there are ways around it. And I'm going to briefly mention two of them. One of them very quickly, and the second one in a little bit more detail. And the reason for it is that there's a connection between how you might solve this problem and the possibility of dark matter being in some proposal like this. Yeah?
Regarding the temperature of the universe, what about all the grid processes that were at much higher scale than anything.
Like?
Inflation, baryogenesis,
they are all exponential problems. And if you want to model...
Okay, the Big Bang itself. So there's still be starting from a very high temperature, and all particles were in equilibrium at some point.
Well,
now they're just saying, no, it's starting from an MeV, a temperature of MeV, then never got farther than that.
Well, remember, from the point of view of this of just standard cosmology, what we know for certain is we know we can extrapolate physics back to infinity. And we have no direct probes earlier than that. We have indirect probes in this, in the nature of the density perturbations that seem to have been imprinted on the CME, of which a wonderfully interesting model is the inflation, a way to see why those fluctuations are of the type that they are and have the nearly scale invariant form. Now, having said that, though, you can then go through this type of procedure to see whether is there a way to do inflation but at much lower scales? Is there a way to do baryogenesis at lower scales? And those become problems, exercises in seeing whether this type of scheme can go. Some of those things you can do, some of them become very hard. And that's, this has been studied in the literature in detail, but these are exactly the questions you should ask about any of the direct probes earlier than that is why you can still contemplate this. Alright, I want to talk about these effects. In other words, cutoff scale effects in the body. Because naively, this would seem to just kill this thing, right? What we had last time was things like a proton decay operator, and four fermions violate baryon and lepton number. If this were M star, this would completely kill the model. You can estimate how quickly the proton decays into something like minutes or an hour or something like seconds. Very fast. How do we get around this? Well, the interesting thing with proposals like this is that there are often creative ways of trying to get around it. One of them is, we have taken all the matter and placed it on a single surface in the extra dimension. So, standard model here with quarks and leptons and something. But it didn't have to be that way. It could be that you could try to localize matter to different spots in the extra dimension. In particular, you could imagine to do the following, where you have, say, quarks localized to one surface in the extra dimension, and leptons to another surface. This naively looks like it could have some problems. As long as I have, say, gauge interactions, Higgs, and other fields, as long as they are somehow diffused in this bulk of the space-time, what does that mean in practice? It means that they have to be higher dimensional fields that interact on with these two surfaces. And moreover, they better interact equally otherwise within the C deviations. But the interactions, of course, might not seem to be photons. If that's true, then you could imagine that these things could be separated. And once I integrate out over this size, whatever the size could be, these will have the appearance of being right on top of each other in the end. So at low energies, it could look no different, but at high energy, they look like they're separate. Why is this valuable? Because what this means is that the wave functions of these particles in the extra dimension perhaps can be localized like that. And so then the effective size of this operator here, the coefficient, while there is still in principle an operator 1 over n star squared, there is a coefficient that is now no longer 1, but it is proportional to the overlap of these two wave functions. You can try to actually realize the scenario to solve this problem. And it's straightforward to do it. I mean, it's really not, it's not a rocket science. The problem with this, so aside from understanding how you localize the fermions to each side, that takes a little bit of effort, but over time, it's easy to see that. The problem with this is you can already smell something that's a little suspicious, because there are now a number of scales in the problem. There's now the fundamental quantum gravity scale and star. There is a scale corresponding to the width of this wave function. Let's call it W inverse. W being the width, inverse being the scale associated with that. This scale had better be smaller than that, or the distance scale had better be larger than that. Otherwise, I can't even understand what it means to talk about a width. Okay. And then I need to separate them far enough so that this suppression is big enough. And, well, if these are localized with some sort of Gaussian distribution, then the overlap can be Gaussian, can be, you know, almost like Boltzmann suppressed. Okay? It's exponentially suppressed as they come together. But that still requires some distance separation between the two. And so then there's another scale, which is this length here. So you end up with a tower of scales, a length, a width, and m star. And I won't go through this, but when you put in the numbers to see what you need to do to try to remove the proton decay problem, you see that you've got to, you know, have moderate separations, maybe order 10-ish between these to make this go. Once you put gauge fields and Higgs in an extra dimension that can talk to each side, they will then, if they're in an extra dimension, they will have their own Kaluza Klein tower, which we're going to talk about in a second, in slightly different context. And that tower, we had better not see any of those modes. The problem there is that unlike the graphitons, which couple only 1 over n plus, the modes that sit in this bulk of the space-time will couple potentially as a weakening direction. And if that's true, then we better not have already seen them, and so this scale would better be above a TeV. Now we've got a hierarchy of scales, a TeV, maybe 10, maybe 100 TeV. So this is a way where you can try to remove this problem. You can remove the problems associated with cutoff scale operators violating the global symmetries of the standard model, but at the price of putting in structure. You can think about how you observe this and how you find it, and there are interesting things. I'm going to give you a slightly different take on this.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
What is the origin of the extra modes of gauge fields? Because the L is not a compact. L is a distance of directed compact.
Good, yeah. So what it corresponds to is it has to be something where, yeah, it depends on how I want to look at this. If I look at this as a continuum, you know, on some large dimension in these two surfaces, close to another but not on top of another, then all I need is that the gauge and the Higgs fields have to have some wave function that is spread out across this distance scale, L. But what does that mean to have a, what does it mean to say that I've got a field in an extra dimension with some width? It means that in a Kaluza-Klein expansion, it would correspond to modes that have to characterize, that have to add up to give me that width. It's just like a Fourier expansion. You know, I have some signal, and I need to add up whatever the modes I need to be able to get that signal that I get out. If I've got something that's flat over this distance scale, I can expect I'm going to have modes that have a frequency that is characteristic of the scale. And in field theory language, frequency corresponds to the mass. So that's why the mass has to be in this stuff.
It's like a boundary condition for...
Hold that thought. 1 second. That's the next thing I'm going to do. Yeah. Okay. I now want to make this, I talked about this in sort of a very qualitative way, but there is something you can do that is, more concrete, and has its own amusement. What you can do is to assume that not just quarks and leptons, sorry, not just gauge fields and Higgs, but also quarks and leptons, the whole standard model exists in extra dimensions. This is so-called on the surface, this seems like a completely crazy idea, even crazier than what we've already been talking about. Because, well, first of all, we haven't seen any KK modes of anything. And even if you get a model like this to go, we know that there's a distance scale where the first modes can show up and they can't be very close to us. But there's the possibility that just as we can have some number of dimensions which only gravity can move, there could be some number of extra dimensions in which gauge fields in fermions galore. And surprisingly, this has two very interesting consequences. One is it provides a different mechanism to suppress proton decay, as well as electron number violation and other qualities, as well as providing the possibility of another accidental symmetry that would stabilize the lightest Drusen-Klein particle. That means a dark matter. So this is a case where here's TeV physics. We started with just trying to, you know, cut off the theory of TeV, and then we said, oh, but you know, we've got these operators. How do we understand that? Okay, well, we need to modify how the standard model interacts and how it, what it looks like in extra dimensions, and then as a consequence of that, there's the possibility of, you know, a dark matter cannon. Let me proceed. So from here on out, let me now talk as if we have cases that I'm going to be considering where we have either one or two extra dimensions. There could be an additional set that keep gravity low. This is sort of in the back of my mind, but I won't have to harp on that. So these are one or two extra dimensions that have a scale that is L inverse, which we saw over there is probably TeV-ish. So you've now got a situation where, you know, here's space-time. There is, you know, some number of dimensions here for gravity, and there's some tiny little ones like that in which the standard model is. Sounds great. Okay. What would be, well, how would this work? Let me talk about the specific case where you can try to suppress these operators. And that specific case is one in which is two extra dimensions or 60. It's actually 60 on a torus modded by a Z2. What does this mean? It means it's actually an orbifold, which is a space-time with boundaries. And the space-time with boundaries, the reason that we introduced this is because there are going to be some modes of the theory which we will not want to see as zero modes. And the orbifold allows you to project those out. Similar type of thing also happens in string theory. From the field theory point of view, though, we can just go ahead and write this down. So if I have fermions and gauge fields in two extra dimensions, the action is the usual thing. Let's say two. And now I've got fermions and gauge fields. Dimensions, and if I had my signs and everything, like there's the one quarter and then there's other things that I'm adding, that's right. It's one. There we go. What happens when we go into extra dimensions? Well, now the dimensions of the fields change. And it's straightforward to see how they change. For a fermion, we can just start counting, right? So we've got minus 4, minus 2, our action, dimensionless, better be. So this whole thing has to soak up 6. Now, this is a derivative with respect to now gamma matrices in 6 dimensions. Minus 1 derivative leaves me with 5 dimensions divided among 2 fermions, 5 halves. Okay, so fermions have dimensions 5 halves in the case of 16. and scalars, or bosons, gauge fields or scalars. Again, you go through the same argument, but maybe the easiest thing is to just look at a scalar field itself, even though I'm not going to concern myself with that. But if we had a scalar field, it would just be d v bottom, and there's a complex scalar. Two derivatives, soak up the rest, it then has to be 4 divided by 2 equals 2. All right, so the dimensions of the fields change. Fermions also change in another qualitative way. And this is something that we didn't encounter before, because we were only talking about gravitons. So fermions change because the representation of the Lorentz group in extra dimensions is different. The representations of a in Lorentz group in a higher dimensional space time are different. And I don't want to belabor this point, but other than to just state what the result is, you can convince yourself that just like fermions in 4 dimensions are really coming out of, you can think of it as like an SU2 cross SU2 representation of the SO4, but it's really SO3.1. Same thing, you promote this to 6 dimensions, SO6, then has an SU4, SU4, okay, and each one of those can have its own fermion representation. So it actually ends up being that the Weyl fermion so 6 dimensions has Weyl fermions. In 4 dimensions, they were just a 2-component object. In 6 dimensions, because of the SU4, they're a 4-component object. I'm just stating that quickly without proof. Just as in 4 dimensions, you have 2 Weyl spinners create a Dirac spinner, an 8-component object. 2 Weyl spinners in 6 dimensions also create an 8-component Dirac object. And then, not surprisingly, the gamma matrices corresponding to the extra dimensions, gamma m, and 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, there we go, and then 4, 5. So these objects are going to be 8 by 8 matrices. That's what gets into this D here. So here we've got a D, M, gamma, M, like the D slash, these gamma M's on these guys. In even numbers of dimensions, we have the ability to form the analog of a gamma 5 in 4 dimensions. In this case, we might call it a gamma 7. This is the projection operator that allows us to take a Dirac spinner and project out one of the two moments in the first one. What you can do, the picture in mind, is to imagine that the standard model fields themselves, so fermions, Q, U, E, L, E, all of these get promoted to 6 dimensions. That means that if I was working in a 2-component notation, each one of these have to be promoted to 4-component objects to be able to just, you know, be a representation of the 6D Lorentz group, but then that's the joy of the CQ, because this projection allows us to take these higher dimensional objects, these multi-component objects, and then project down to just a 2-component fermion as the zero, as the mode with no mass. So that the standard model exists exactly as is at the zero mode level. And only at these Kaluza-Klein excitation levels do you see all the multitude of fermions. So maybe if I try to draw this, here's the zero mode level with the standard model fermions, and then 2-component or 4-component Dirac objects, however you want to write them, and then this will project into a series of states. There will be those that correspond to the promotion of these 2-component objects into the extra dimension with their size, and then the additional the additional components that you can think of as coming in for each quantum level as you go on. And it is this Z2 that projects out the would-be zero modes of this tau state. You know, I'm saying this fast, but I'm also repeating the time. So. All right. This scenario with two extra dimensions has then two coordinates, y1, y2. You can form from that a one of the subgroups of this extra dimensional, of this larger group of Lorentz transformations, is a U1. A U1 symmetry that allows you to rotate among the different components of this extra dimension. This is, forgive me for doing it this way, but for lack of time, I have to do it this way. Without proof, I'm going to just simply state how these fermions, when they are put into six dimensions, how they transform them into U1. That's the one piece I have to say. All of these fields transform as -1/2, that's what I have right here, transform as a charge of -1/2 under this U1. Now, why is that significant? This is significant because if I try to write operators involving these fields, I have to now create combinations of the field that make this U1 invariant so that the whole extra dimensional theory goes. One of the operators that we've had before that is of a concern is this QQQL. But now I can see that I can read off the charges from this extra U1, this U1 in the extra dimensions, and see that this has non-zero U1 charge. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean to say I can't write some operator, but it's going to have to be something where I have, first of all, I'm going to end up having to have an equal number of baryons and leptons, because if I have an unequal number, well then, I'll end up with an unequal number of this U1 charge. So, let me write what the lowest dimensional operator is that nevertheless violates baryon and lepton. And it turns out that the lowest dimensional operator is L dagger D quantity Q H dagger all over. This is the cutoff scale of where this theory is. So, I need 3 D's so as to make decision 3 invariant. I've got 3 doublets here and 1 here, so I can make the SU2 contractions work. You can work out the U1 charges and see that this works, U1 hypercharge. And then this U1, you can see, is invariant. This is a delta L equal to 3 delta V equal to 1 operator. This is a way to have proton decay, but with emitting 3 leptons rather than the usual 1 in this case. You can then work out what does this correspond to. This is the operator in the extra dimensional language. This is why if you start doing counting the fields here, you'll think, well, wait a second, it doesn't look like the 11 is right. Remember, we have to count the dimension of the higher dimensional fields to work out what this is. But you can then Kaluza-Klein reduce this, in other words, expand this out in terms of zero modes, and what that corresponds to is, well, let's plug in the BEV for the Higgs. There is a lambda, the 11th power here. And then there is the expansion of these things into the component fields, the zero-mode fields, and it looks like nu. Let me just get this right here. M bar e y squared. So, one neutrino and then 3 leptons, 2 leptons, 3 of these, And because I've had to take in the extra dimensional fields and expand them out in the extra dimension, you remember there was a square root Vn factor for the KK graviton, well, there's going to be one of those same factors for each of the leptons. The dimension to soak up the dimensions of the higher dimensional fields. And so that corresponds to putting in here, the length. So now we can just read this off and make sure that, you know, life is good. We do a sanity check, right? So there is three halves, three. Here, 3 squared is 6. Okay, 6, 1, 7. Did I do that right? I think, right? Yeah, 7 up top. And then in the denominator, there is 11 minus 5, which is 6. And I don't think that makes sense. Okay. Three, six, nine. Happy count. That's the dimension of the fields here. Plus 1 is 10. And in the denominator, we have 11 minus 5 is 6. And that is in the easy dimension 4 octave. So I mean, this whole thing is as sure. What's the consequence of this? Well, it means that you can actually have, rearranging the d's appropriately, you can have some proton that comes in, goes through this operator, spits out a bunch of leptons, and depending on how I arrange the d's, some quarks, and this ends up giving me a proton decay rate, but a proton decay rate is suppressed by a huge power. So all I have to do is to calculate what size L lambda can be, and you can work out what the range of the proton. Simple enough, though, this can be made small enough that it won't violate the balance. So this is a completely different way of trying to get around this problem of the proton decay. You can show also that the same type of operators, or the same type of dangerous operators that violate lepton number, can also be suppressed, again, using this. All right, so this is the situation. Why step through this? This may seem very sort of baroque and complicated, and in some ways it is baroque and complicated. But what it shows is that there are even ways around the naive problem of, oh, you know, I cut the theory off, I'm just going to be getting it and I stop thinking. That's not necessarily true. There may be ways around it. You have to think through each proposal as you go. Inevitably, though, nothing works perfectly. Just like over here, I had to have a separation of scales, L inverse, the width, and the fundamental quantum gravity scale. Over here, I also have to have a separation of scales, but now the separation is between this cutoff, lambda, and the size L. Okay? And this separation has to be made in order 10 number or so. So that means that the fundamental cutoff is still up well above the TEV, maybe 10 TEV or higher, and so then the fine tuning associated with the Higgs is still not as good as we would have liked. It would be 10 TEVs or more. So this is the basic idea of how we go about this. I was going to talk about the dark matter candidate in this, but in light of time, I think I want to just state in words what the situation is. And then I want to talk just very briefly about starting points. So, questions on this? Yeah. I'm sorry, say again. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Spin doesn't change.
Is there any restriction from any consideration of standard matter that restricts us to d equals c?
No. Good question. So there are two sets of anomaly cancellation issues. One of them is within the standard model itself. The second one is with respect to gravity. In 6D, there is a gravitational anomaly, but that, so that requires potentially additional degrees of freedom to cancel that. They don't necessarily have anything to do with the standard model. But more generally, you know, once you promote a theory, so for example, once I promoted this theory into six dimensions, then this pairing up of these fields is what allowed me to see that even if I just go to five dimensions, this is anomaly free, and so then it's fine. So it's, you know, however high. So it's something you have to worry about, but in practice, it's, yeah. Okay. Let me just say in words something because I think I can probably do this quickly. If you have a theory like this, and you have these kinds of symmetries associated with the theory, you can imagine that then, as I project this theory down to the zero mode, so as I take this theory and I do a Poisson-Klein extension, there are some additional symmetries of the extra-dimensional space time. There is one that allows you to actually stabilize this KK mode, or the first excitation of the standard model. So it could be a gauge field, could be a fermion. Don't know what it is. That would depend on the spectrum here. And basically, what that corresponds to is an accidental symmetry of the extra-dimensional space time. What it in fact corresponds to is something that looks almost like a remnant of translation invariance, but it's like a discrete remnant, a discrete translation. Okay? So, and that extra Z2 is actually enough to make this thing stable and light and good. So it's an interesting way to still nevertheless get dark matter out, and it's one of these cases where now you have a particle which is aboard the TPD scale that came out just because, oh, we wanted to try to solve this problem of higher dimensional operators, and yet you can ensure that it has the right interactions to work out to get a relic abundance that's at the right size. There's been a whole number of papers that do that. Right? So it's an amusing option. But before I completely run out of time, that's the first time, I want to talk just a little bit about strong magnets. Okay, so you have spent a long amount of time while I labor through this extra dimensional business, and partly I did it to show you the richness of one of these structures that is there, and how it's possible that the cost of TPD is low at a TPD, and do true quantum graphics. There's a completely different way of trying to approach the hierarchy problem using symmetries or using dynamics. Probably will take about 10, 15 minutes, and then that'll be it. I will not try to go too far, but just falling asleep too much. All right. So I'm going to completely switch gears to... Okay. First things first. QCD. Standard model, here's the QCD coupling, it's a function of energy, this is a log scale, we measured it up here and in many other places, so we know we observed the running, and it's about well-known. It is a dimension 4 operator, has a log dependence on the scale, we talked about the logs before. It starts at some high energy value. Think of it this way, starting point of water, some higher now, runs down and then gets strong at a scale here, and the QCD, the characteristic scale and the strong interactions. What did this do for the standard model? when the strong interactions became strong, it meant that there are diagrams in gluons that will then couple various quarks together, binding together, and for light quarks, it will lead to a condenser. So it means, for example, and in particular, if I have left-handed quarks here, and say right-handed quarks, gluons coupled to both, as it gets strong, these things bind together, giving me a condensate that is of order lambda QCD. We know that it has to be Q because just look at the dimensions. We know the characteristic scale is this strong scale. The only issue is a matter of an order one, typically 4 pi. So I'm not going to be too careful about the 4 pi. What does this do? Well, previously, we had left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions that we could rotate independently. We could do phase rotations independently. Now, in QCD, there are two light quarks to go down. So if I characterize them as, say, a doublet, U left, V left, as well as U right, V right, as a global symmetry, this corresponds to an SU2 left cross SU2 right, where I can do rotations among these components. Now, in practice, of course, so you can do these rotations. This is gauge. This keeps only the U1 gauge. So once this condensate forms, the Q left, Q right, which is like U left, U right, or V left, U right. This condensation prevents me from being able to do SU2 left or SU2 right rotations simultaneously. There's only one diagonal combination that survives. You can just see this. I can try to do a rotation here and do a rotation there. But there's one combination of that that will work and one combination that won't. So this global symmetry breaks to some, you know, diagonal symmetry. And in fact, the diagonal symmetry, since this is gauged and only the U1 is gauged here, because this diagonal symmetry is just like the magnitude. Okay, but this, upon doing this breaking, this global symmetry, and again, if we have spontaneous breaking of global symmetries, we get global symmetry. And in the case of QCD, those goldstones are exactly the binders. Three ostensibly massless scalar fields corresponding to the generators of this. Some of them carry charge because, of course, we've gauged the discrete subgroup that we get out of this. Okay, so these goldstones. The pions represent the broken generators of this chiral symmetry that was spontaneously broken by the condensated QCD. The electroweak theory has massive W plus, 0, W minus, which contain in them gold cells, W plus. I'm trying to write lowercase to represent the scalar components that were absorbed by these gauge bosons to form the longitudinal components. All we know for certain is that, you know, these really exist. How do we know that? Well, because we measured. Measure the gauge boson masses, and we know that they have to have three components. Beyond that, we don't know the nature of them. Obviously, the similarity between these goldstones here, and the fact that we've already seen in nature once this idea that, okay, you know, QCD becomes strong and spontaneously breaks a global symmetry giving you gold stones, maybe the same thing can happen here. So, and that idea is called technicolor. So this is a particular implementation of the idea that strong dynamics of a new gauge group will spontaneously break the global symmetries of that theory of which the electroweak theory is part, and break the electroweak theory down to electromagnetism. But it really is just like what happens in QCD. Well, for this to go, to make technicolor work as a model, you need a number of things. And in practice, I'll state this right now without any further ado, there is no 100% completely working model. All there are pieces, some pieces which seem to work remarkably well, some pieces which, and some pieces which are very poor. So there is no one model that's okay, but there are, when we get now. In some cases, the reasons that we don't know how one thing works or another has to do with just because it is shrouded by strong dynamics, and we don't understand it. But in other cases, there are really sort of more fundamental obstacles that seem to make this arguable, and just conflict with experiment in several cases. If this were to correspond, if scale up QCD, if you like, technicolor were to correspond to a way to break electroweak symmetry, well, what we need to do is to change this condensate scale up to the electroweak scale, and order expectation value, and have some new group that runs down and gets strong, but now it gets strong in a few hundred GeV or so. This can be done. This is, you follow the same procedure that one does here. You just, and you have now additional set of quarks called technicorks. Which, for example, so if I have an SUNTC gauge group, I can do QCD, SU3, but you can generalize to just an SUN group. Minimal technicolor. Corresponds to having something where minimal technicolor corresponds to having some series of fields. I'll write them as T's, but really they're just like this Q and U left, U right. Same type of thing. They transform in some way under this gauge group, say as a fundamental representation, and a couple of anti-fundamental representations under SUN, and then they transform non-trivially under SU2 left plus U1 hypercharge, say as a doublet, and this is an anomaly-free combination of fermions with respect to the gauge symmetries. Once SUNTC gets strong, the TT plus, TT minus form the condensate that is now of order lambda technicolor. And this condensate breaks the global symmetry, the SU2 left cross SU2 right, SU2 right being these two components, down to the diagonal. We've now gauged the whole symmetry. This breaks it down to electromagnetism. And it's that simple. Now, we can again count the number of gold stones that we've got. Well, this is an SU2 left global symmetry here, and an SU2 right, taking both of these two components over here. So we get three gold stones out, just like we had over here, five plus pi minus not, and that they become these three particles. This seems like, wow, that's brilliant. This is the way it works, right? it's obvious. I mean, you know, it happened before in the standard model, it's going to happen again, it's no problem. Right? It works wonderfully to break the electrical reasoning. The problems come right after you get to this point. This is where the fun, this is where the fun sort of stops, and the pain begins. The first thing, the first most trivial thing you can think is, okay, great, so I've now broken electrical symmetry, I've given the W and Z masses for the fermions. Because the Higgs mechanism now gave us three goldstones, but also a mechanism to give us fermion masses. Where are fermion masses going to come from? Let me take just a few more minutes so that you can get a feeling. Otherwise, you're going to come away thinking, ah, Technicolor, I've got to work on it right now. And I wouldn't discourage that. I need to tell you a couple more things before you get, before you run off. Alright, so how do you get fermion mass as well? The characteristic scale, or the mechanism by which electroweak symmetry was broken in this case, was through this condensate. So somehow we have to communicate, if you like, this condensate to the fermions. The obvious thing to do would be to have some operator, and if you like, I'm going to write this just schematically, something like this, some higher dimensional operator, dimension 6, which combines Techne fermions with standard model fermions, such that when T plus gets a condensate, right, this will go over into lambda Tc cubed divided by lambda squared, this becomes the mass of the standard model fermion. So when I'm attacking on the square over, I don't know what the scale is. I know what the fermion masses are, but I don't know what the scale is. I can work out what the scale has to be given you what I know about the fermion. For very light fermions, you see that the scale has to be heavy. And this is an amusing difference in this case. And then with the Higgs mechanism, the heavier the fermion, the larger the coupling. Okay, and in this case, the heavier the fermions, the smaller the cutoff scale that associated with your theory.
How about the coupling cost?
Indeed, you're absolutely right. I'm taking that to be one, but I don't know what it could be. It could be small, and in fact, in general, because these things are strongly coupled, I might think that it's actually an order 4 ion. So if I do my 4-5 counting, I'll see how that goes. Clearly, you can see an issue, though, already, without going into it. Here's the simplest issue possible. This is a scale that has to be clearly larger than lambda Technicolor. So that means that this number is a suppressed coupling. It's you know, smaller than one, probably much smaller than one. Yet, we know of one quark that's got a Yukawa couple almost exactly one, dot quark. So the dot quark has a Yukawa couple almost exactly one. How do you get that out of here? That would mean you'd have to have new operators showing up at a scale, lambda, that is on the same size as lambda technical. But we've already probed physics well beyond the scale of 100 GeV. We've probed several hundred and in some indirect operators of 3 GeV and beyond. We've seen no new strong dynamics, no any. So, just getting a top quark now, you're already in trouble. But that's the least of your concerns. Okay? If it were just the top quark, we still, this is the most amazing. You can already see another problem. How do I get an operator like this? Where is this going to come from? Isn't this just postponing my pain to lambda? In some ways, it is. But, you know, we've seen this before. I mean, this looks like G Fermi. This looks like just a Fermi interaction. There's some new gauge bosons. They get a heavier mass, and through their exchange, connect to this operator. You can imagine doing that. where we have now some, let me write it a little differently here, some Technicolor fermion, some standard model fermion, an exchange of some Newtonian boson that has to have a large mass of order lambda. And then after this stage boson mass is integrated out, it leads to the sun. So now you've got another problem, under the mass. So now you've got to have not just a new strong dynamics theory to lead to the masses of these stage bosons, but you would need some additional dynamics to lead to the masses of these stage bosons. These are called extended technicolor. And it just means the gauge group of technicolor is larger, and it in some way will allow you to mix the standard model fermions themselves with the technicolor fermions. This doesn't obviously happen for this particular choice of quantum numbers, but you can choose a set of quantum numbers under a technicolor group that is anomaly-free, very much like just the standard model fermion, QUDLE, where all of those are now technicolor fermions, and they can mix among each other. All right, so I've got a little more complication, extended technicolor, I've got to make a larger group, but, you know, maybe this could still go. Now you run into the big problem. One of the big problems. One of the big problems is that if I can mix sterile fermions with technicolor through these EDC gauge bosons, I should be able to also mix standard model fermions together, in particular, do it with different generations. This leads to violations of flavor, violations of the global flavor symmetry associated with the fermions, and it's violations of the global flavor that go like 1 over lambda squared, but that's a little deceptive. Because what is lambda squared is actually nothing but the fermion mass. So fermion mass is lambda TCQ by the lambda squared. So lambda squared is nothing but lambda TCQ divided by the fermion mass. So that this operator actually goes like m fermion over lambda TC times F, different generations, lambda TC squared. So this is like the electroweed scale. This is really low. And this is a small coupling, but not necessarily that small. Okay? It turns out not small enough. You need actually this quantity to be squared before it can be even small enough. And that is not what happens in chemistry. Because fundamentally, the fermion mass comes from these types of operators. And once you do that, this is so you can already see that there's a flavor problem in that. Right? And so, as I was telling you, there's a potential flavor problem in extra dimensions, there's a flavor problem in 2D, there's definitely a flavor problem in that. Getting around this and many of the associated problems of this is a whole industry. And you know, the fact that this itself here seems to work so nicely is why people push on this a lot to see how far they can go. We don't know. There is no absolutely, completely, 100% successful model of this. But there are definitely ways to get around it. And the ways to get around it boil down to trying to modify the size of these effects. And there are ways of trying to do that when the technicolor group itself is not deeply coupled between the extended technicolor scale down to the weak scale, but is actually stronger. And that's called wide. This is the way to go. There is, of course, even another set of concerns, which is you have these, you generate these goldstones, there is no Higgs, yet you saw from Jim Wells' lectures that the electroweak precision measurements have pinned down the Higgs to be in a mass around a few hundred, 100 GeV or 150 GeV or so. That's consistent with electroweak data. And in particular, a heavy Higgs, which would correspond to strong coupling, is inconsistent with that. So that's another problem. So these kinds of concerns mean that technicolor, as it stands, as a pure theory, was hard to go, but it's still one of the possibilities. So as my last comment on this, I will say that One of the interesting ways to go, one of the ways that has come up in the last several number of years, is to have not only the W, not only these gold cells, okay, come out, not only these as the spontaneously yielding global symmetries, but to also generate the Higgs, to have a full Higgs double generated from the technetonic dynamics. And if you can arrange that you get a Higgs doublet out and you get a quartic coupling, you can have something that looks like a composite Higgs at low energies, which actually is secretly technically fermions. It is secretly strong dynamics at a higher energy scale. Okay, and there are some very creative ways to do that. One of them is called Little Higgs. And I think Cal will probably talk a little bit about that model and some of the signatures about Higgs. Anyway, I hope this was useful. This was a sort of a lightning overview of a few ideas that come out of this. You know, the summary is just, look, the LHC is coming in less than 1 year. The physics beyond the standard model is there to try to understand some of these problems, the connection between dark matter and the hierarchy problem, and seeing, you know, how this can go. But you know, no one proposal is completely solid, but there are many ideas, and they all lead to different signals that you need to work out to see how well you can find this at the LHC. So, you know, keep thinking. You've got a year to submit your information. Good luck. Thanks.